At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
From Merriam-Webster today, a definition. Central bank. Noun. A national bank that operates to establish monetary and fiscal policy and to control the money supply and interest rate. Oh, that it were so simple. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is September the 28th, today, Wednesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We speak today of two central banks, the one here, the Federal Reserve, and the one over there, the Bank of England. And how what they are doing to meet this very peculiar economic moment is affecting, and this is going to sound like I'm exaggerating, but trust me when I tell you I'm not, what central banks are doing right now is affecting everything. So, the Fed. Raising interest rates, as you know, one very tangible manifestation of which is that the currencies of nearly every major economy on the planet have fallen against the dollar, some of them a lot, from the British pound, about which more in a minute, to the South Korean won. The basic technicals are that the dollar's been strengthening this year as investors everywhere are moving their money into the United States to A, keep it safe during a very shaky economic time, and B, to take advantage of our rising interest rates. But that, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports to get us going, has some consequences.
New Yorker Ryan Sheffield just spent a long weekend in the UK.
The pound had fallen so far at the time, it was very affordable for just a four-day weekend.
A strong dollar is great for importers, too. Everything's cheaper. It is not great for exporters.
We make hands-on learning materials and we sell in over 100 countries.
Rick Waldenberg is the CEO of Learning Resources.
A stronger dollar makes our products much more expensive. Where we have the biggest problem is in the UK. The buying power of the pound has just collapsed.
Now multiply that across not just exporters, but all the global companies based in the U.S. Alan Robinson is an advisor at RBC Wealth Management.
If you look at the S&P 500, something like 40% of the revenues derived by the market in general come from outside of the U.S.
Outside the U.S., these companies earn money in currencies that are now worth much less than a year ago. And it is outside the U.S., where a stronger dollar is taking the most dramatic toll in general. Ishwar Prasad is professor of economics at Cornell.
For many countries around the world, there is a fair amount of debt that they hold that is denominated in U.S. dollars.
That debt has gotten much more expensive, and that is a big problem in the world's most fragile economies.
Our foreign debt is 100 billion USD.
Ajit Wasanta Lianagate lives in southern Sri Lanka, where he works for a nonprofit. Sri Lanka's economy was already in shambles, partly because of the pandemic. A stronger dollar has made debt repayments more expensive and imported goods, too. The country is so starved of reserves to pay for ever more costly imports that it just up and banned the import of hundreds of goods.
Cars, refrigerators, dairy products.
Inflation in Sri Lanka is upwards of 70%.
before the crisis, the price of an egg is 15 rupees, 1.5. Now it's 60 rupees an egg.
The U.S. dollar has gained a lot of value, and for that, it has commanded a heavy price the world over. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Central bank number two on the Marketplace Hit Parade today is the Bank of England, which this morning made kind of a holy cow announcement. Over the next 2.5 weeks, the B of E is going to buy up as much long-term UK government debt as it can get its hands on. Regular listeners to this program will recognize that as quantitative easing, what the Fed started doing to help this economy get out of the Great Recession. The BOE says it's trying to restore orderly market conditions. That's a quote, because the fact is that markets in the UK have been anything but orderly since the government announced big tax cuts the other day that it plans to pay for by going way deeper into debt. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
The Bank of England is stepping in and buying bonds because the interest rates on those bonds have been rising quickly, and buying them will push interest rates down. Sebastian Malaby, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, says rising rates were threatening the stability of Britain's bond market.
Both the bond market and its functioning, the users of those bonds in pension funds and so forth, and then potentially also the government's borrowing costs and solvency going forward.
Now, if trying to push rates down sounds unusual, Malaby says, central banks around the world, including the Bank of England, have been raising interest rates to combat inflation.
Those two imperatives push in the opposite direction. You know, if you want to stabilize inflation, you have to raise rates. If you want to stabilize the bond market, you have to cut rates.
That might sound like the Bank of England is trying to chug caffeine and alcohol at the same time. But Jim Vogel at FHN Financial says you can think of the Bank of England's bond buying plan as a short-term fix.
Once they can accomplish any kind of stability through the middle of October, their plan is to raise short-term interest rates enough by the end of the year.
And that could eventually help boost the value of the pound, which, as Sabri was just saying, has been falling relative to the strong dollar. Zachary Griffiths with the research company Credit Sites says that has the Bank of England in a tough spot.
Because the weakening pound adds to inflationary pressures, at least at the margin.
But even though the Bank of England is doing a temporary 180 on interest rates, the Federal Reserve certainly is not. That could keep the dollar strong and the pound weak. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Sebastian Malaby, by the way, wrote a great biography of Alan Greenspan. It's called The Man Who Knew. We had him on the program to talk about it. I'm sure it's on our website someplace. On Wall Street today, you mentioned quantitative easing. Even if it's not happening here, oh my, traders get real happy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With Hurricane Ian now fully ashore in Florida, the power outages have started and will surely spread. To be clear, there's really no way to completely weatherproof an electricity grid. See also that winter storm in Texas a couple of years ago. But there are things utilities can do to make their grids more resilient. The catch, of course, is that the price tag for doing that is real, real high. So we asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to add up the costs and benefits.
First things first. Completely weatherproofing the electricity grid from natural disasters is simply not possible.
You cannot protect everything from everything all of the time.
That's Scott Aronson at the Edison Electric Institute. He says utilities shouldn't necessarily be thinking about how to gold plate their power networks.
But if you can minimize the impact of that incident, if you can respond and recover or rebuild or restore after an incident, that's a form of resilience as well.
And Caitlin Bunker at the Rocky Mountain Institute says the use of that extreme weather buzzword resilience is actually fairly recent to her ears.
Prior to 2017, the word resilience very rarely came up.
Then Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico and left many without power for months. That's when utilities and governments started tossing that word around. But she says there's a problem with translating the idea of resilience into something tangible.
There's not necessarily ways to measure the benefit that brings. So it's a little harder to quantify.
Now, we often talk of putting transmission lines underground as a way to make the grid stronger, but that's really expensive. And if you have a storm like Hurricane Ian with really strong winds and also lots of rain, putting those lines underground might not help. Peter Larson at the Berkeley Lab in the Department of Energy says, unfortunately, there's no one single fix here.
There's a lot of different environmental factors at play that change the strategy of how you make the grid more resilient.
And those eventually footing the bill to make that resilience happen? You guessed it, the ratepayers. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Gavin Newsom, the governor of the great state of California, signed a law yesterday that's going to change the rules of salary negotiations here. Among other things, it obliges most companies to publish salary ranges when they post a job. The latest and certainly the biggest state population-wise example of a growing trend in salary transparency laws. Colorado came first in 2021. New York City, Washington State, and the state of New York all have them coming. As Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, the idea is that reducing secrecy around pay might help reduce the pay gaps for women and people of color.
When Denver contract administrator Amanda was looking for a job a few years ago, salary discussions were kind of an afterthought. She asked we not use her full name so she could speak freely about current and past employers. At her last position, she says, salary numbers didn't come up until well into her second interview.
To be honest, like I was so kind of shocked by how low the salary was that I almost didn't take it when it was offered to me.
But she had already invested so much time and effort, so she did, and promised herself never again.
I literally won't apply to positions that don't show salary anymore.
Because Amanda works in Colorado, where salary ranges are now required in job postings, that hasn't been hard. She started a new job earlier this year.
The increase in salary I got this last time was much larger than anything I've seen before. I just think that this gives everybody a little bit more power and knowledge.
Pay is generally the most important factor for job seekers, so putting that right up front could lead to more job seeking, says Andrew Flowers, a labor economist at recruitment software company AppCast.
It attracts more job seekers who are, frankly, shopping around, and in the long run, that can help recruiting.
An AppCast analysis of federal data showed labor force participation, the share of people working or looking for work, increased faster in Colorado after the pay transparency law went into effect compared to neighboring state Utah, where pay transparency is not required.
For many job seekers outside of Colorado, looking for work is like searching for a home on Zillow with no home price.
But the changes to the labor market weren't all positive. AppCast also found that job openings in the state fell compared to those in Utah. And it might have something to do with a phenomenon Denver tech worker Chris Chacon noticed while searching for a job last year.
I would see in a job description, nobody's from Colorado is welcome to apply.
To avoid listing salaries, national companies began excluding applicants from Colorado. These listings became so common, they've been collected at a website, ColoradoExcluded.com.
When I first saw it, I didn't know about the law. I thought maybe it had to do with like our marijuana laws. It's such a weird disclaimer. I don't know. So,
but as more states and cities add these salary posting requirements, they'll become harder for employers to avoid. Jennifer LaStrange leads HR consultancy Red Clover in New Jersey and says many clients are planning to add salary ranges to job postings regardless of their location.
And then we know that if the law changes in that state, we're okay.
But she says it's not as simple as just taking the budget amount for a position and publishing it. Companies need to strategize about whether a salary range will target candidates at the high or low end of experience. Consider what competitors are doing and what effect that salary information could have on current staff.
What they have to offer for new hires might be slightly higher than people who they have already in the organization who have more tenure or more experience.
So she says companies need to be prepared to adjust some existing salaries or have a good explanation for why those differences exist. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Bristle Club Rush, Bog Pimpernel, Shining Dumbledore, Delicate Germanderwort.
Wait, there's going to be another Harry Potter book? Magic later. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 548 points today, 1.8%, closed at 29,683. The NASDAQ picked up 222 points, about 2%, finished at 11,051. The S&P 500 added 71 points, 1.9%, ended at 37.19. The business of pickleball. Yes, pickleball is getting hotter. LeBron James is buying not 7, not 6, not 5, not 4, not 3, not 2, but one expansion team in Major League Pickleball, which is apparently a thing. His partners include NBA players Draymond Green and Kevin Love. Financial terms were not disclosed. Don't yell at me about pickleball. It's a very serious issue in my hometown. It's true. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We have talked a couple of times, I think, about kids getting back to school in person now and the learning loss that a lot of those students have had. Teachers and staff are trying to get things and themselves back on track, but they're doing it, those teachers are, while making less than a lot of their non-teacher peers. So we've gotten Jessica Gomez on the phone. She's the principal at Alice Burney Elementary in the Colton Joint Unified School District here in Southern California. Ms. Gomez, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How are things in elementary school these days? I mean, we should say you're active in the National Principals Association, so it's not just your elementary school I'm asking about.
Yeah, well, so elementary school is busy every single day. So there's you have a calendar, but you rarely follow it.
Yeah. I have vague memories. So more to the point, how are the kids?
You know, the kids are much better than they were last year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, we do have some post-pandemic effects, right, of trauma that a lot mm-hmm. of our students experience. But they're doing so much better than they were last year, for sure.
Good. That is good to hear. Now, let me ask you the labor market question. How are the teachers and staff doing?
So teachers, it's rough. It's tough. The reason why it's a little bit harder than typical, than pre-pandemic, is because we're having to catch kids up. And it's just a matter of doing everything I can as a principal to keep morale high. And if we show up as our best selves, then that's how we show up.
The story, of course, of teachers through the pandemic has been how hard it's been for them and how disaffected a lot of them became. Do you have enough people to staff your classrooms?
So I have enough people to staff my classrooms. Now, I am also a dual language immersion school. Mm-hmm. So to fill dual language immersion positions is even more difficult because you have to have a special bilingual credential. And one of my teachers actually just got hired as an art teacher for the district. So now I'm having to replace her with a dual immersion teacher. Hmm. I have one candidate.
Wow.
One.
Wow.
And, you know, ask a few years ago, I mean, we would get a whole list of applicants.
What happens if your phone rings at six? I don't know if the principal gets these calls. Somebody does, right? That says, yeah. Listen, our fourth grade teacher is out maybe with COVID, and the second grade teacher has to take care of her own child. I mean, what do? Do you have enough subs?
No. So it's almost like you just looked at my phone this morning. That is okay. And for any principal that's listening out there, that is the story of our lives every single day. It's manageable when it's one class, but when you're getting texts in the morning by one teacher, two teachers, three teachers, now that really starts to become a challenge. I actually don't even check my phone when I first get up because I don't even want to see how many texts I have. I give myself some time in the morning before I actually get into that headspace of I have to problem solve now.
Yeah, you gotta manage your phone.
Yes.
So most of your kids are students of color, right?
Yes.
Okay. So let me ask you the future question, right? Going back to the learning loss thing. This is a little depressing, but how long do you think it will take for these kids to catch up?
You know, that's hard to say, but it's definitely going to be a few years out. Huh. We are scrambling as a school, as a district, and a lot of our students, they went through some things and, that we're still dealing with that in terms of the mental health part of it. And there's going to be some things that we're going to have to put into place that is thinking outside the box and being very strategic on what we do with the time we have with them during the school day.
Let me end on a personal question, if I might, Ms. Gomez. Obviously, the pandemic was really hard on kids, really hard on teachers. I imagine it was really hard on administrators like yourself as well. What kept you going through the last 2.5 years?
You know what? I think it was within me to be there for them. And I've been here at the school site for 10 years. So I have a very strong relationship with the students and the staff. And I couldn't see myself walking away from that. Mm-hmm. Even as challenging as it has been. I mean, you've talked about teacher burnout. Talk about principal burnout.
Yeah, I bet. No, I bet.
But we need to continue to take care of ourselves and be able to help lead our staffs in a way that we would hope they can lead their students.
Jessica Gomez is the principal at Alice Burney Elementary. She's in the Colton Joint Unified School District out in the Inland Empire of Southern California. Ms. Gomez, thanks for your time, ma'am. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
While the pound and interest rates and what the government's tax policy might actually mean for the people of the United Kingdom are understandably top of mind over there, there is more to life than the economy, you know. Pain me to say that, though it does. After the pandemic lockdowns of the past couple of years in Britain, a small and somewhat stir-crazy group of hikers and backpackers is done messing around. They're fighting private landowners who restrict public access to some of their green rolling acres. The group's demanding the right to roam unhindered, and they've been staging a series of mass trespasses to drive home their case. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went out to the west of England to get the story.
An essential skill for all committed trespassers, being able to climb over barbed wire without ripping your trousers or damaging the fence.
So just holding on to the tree there, standing on top of the barb itself, and we go near the fence post, because although we don't like barbed wire, we don't want to damage it either.
John Moses of the Right to Roam campaign, clad in skin-tight leggings, gaining access to some countryside he's not allowed to enter, and there's quite a lot of that.
92% of England is off-limits to the public, 92% of the land, 97% of the rivers are not navigable by the public. The situation that we have, which is really the legacy of kind of 1,000 years of aristocratic land ownership in this country, has to change.
His group has been getting that message across with a series of mass trespasses. More than 250 people turned up at this one in the privately owned Worth Forest south of London. They were protesting against a plan for a commercial development in the middle of the forest. It was precisely lack of public access, organiser Dave Bangs told the trespassers, that had made this woodland vulnerable.
We cannot champion its rare, beautiful, important, weird wildlife and landscape if we are not permitted to know it, to fall in love with it. And that's why we're here. Because if we don't,
he led the trespassers on a four-mile trek through the prohibited parts of the forest. There was singing and poetry reading, and in a clearing, Dave Bangs read a list of the forest flora and fauna that he says the development will endanger.
Bristle club rush, bog pimpernel, shining Dumbledore, delicate Germanderwort, golden...
Some of those listening to this looked like hardened protesters, but others did not, like Richard Payne, a retired company director.
Doesn't bother you that you're breaking the law? Breaking the civil law, at least.
Not really, because I'm not breaking and entering somebody's house. I'm not squatting. I'm not going to go in here and put up a tent and live here. So in a sense, we're not strictly trespassing.
And retired deputy head teacher Peppy Erskine.
I just feel it's so important that we preserve the natural world for our mental health. And so I feel justified in trespassing.
Also, Reverend Peter Owen Jones, an Anglican minister.
What about trespassing, though? It's wrong, isn't it?
If human beings have never challenged the rules, we would still be living in the Dark Ages.
Britain's landowners have condemned the outbreak of mass trespassing and criticised the call for unrestricted access to the countryside. Victoria Vivian of the Country Land and Business Association.
The best access for the greatest number comes through a properly mapped and managed footpath system and open access that already exists.
England and Wales, she points out, have 144,000 miles of public pathways. England has 10 national parks covering 10% of the country. She worries that unrestricted roaming will clash with farming, forestry and conservation.
We're suffering from a catastrophic decline in biodiversity in this country, and I'm afraid that nature and people don't go terribly well together.
Indeed, especially when those people are developers, say the Right to Roamers.
We all have a right to be here, and you have a right to enjoy nature. And you should all have
the campaign
right
goes on, the trespassers say, until they get the access that they claim both they and the countryside require. In Worth Forest, England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we started with central banks, we will end it with central banks, and one or two very real-world ramifications of rising interest rates. The Mortgage Bankers Association said today that refi applications to refinance your mortgage, were 84% lower last week than they were the same week a year ago. 84%. Mortgage applications, meanwhile, 29% lower than the same week a year ago. It is important to note here, critical, I would say, once again, that's what the Fed wants to be happening right now. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. And maybe this is just me because I'm slightly obsessed with the agony of the British pound right now. And yes, I know I ought to get a life. Anyway, $1.09 today for the British pound. It's kind of a Bank of England relief rally if you think back to Justin's story at the top of the broadcast. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdell. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.